The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Regime commits murders. They do it in country. They do it outside the country. They do financial crimes. It's a criminal enterprise. And so it's effectively, by allowing Russia to be a member of Interpol, you're allowing criminals to have access to your information.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, March 16th, 2019. Bill Browder, human rights campaigner, foe of Vladimir Putin, seems to get arrested whenever he travels abroad as a result of red notices and diffusion orders issued by Vladimir Putin through the Interpol police organization. These incidents have highlighted the abuse of Interpol by authoritarian governments, and they raise a really important question. Should we be participating in an international police organization with governments that use that organization to harass and arrest their enemies? On the show today, we have two really thoughtful people on this subject with somewhat different points of view, although a lot of common ground. Bill Browder himself, along with Jago Russell, the head of an organization called Fair Trials, which has worked to reform Interpol and make it less susceptible to abuse. Bill argues for kicking the bums out, having police cooperation only between countries that observe civilized norms of law enforcement. Jago makes the case for mending, not ending, an inclusive international police organization. It's a great discussion of a complicated issue. And it's our 400th episode. Whether it's really our 400th episode, we don't know. But we're calling it episode 400. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 400. Woohoo! Bill Browder and Jago Russell debate Interpol and authoritarian governments. So guys, I want to start by just having you both lay out the parameters of the dispute. What is agreed upon between you and what is not agreed upon. So, Bill, give us the case against Interpol and what is the problem here? And then I'll ask Jago to sort of give us which part of that he agrees with and which part of that he thinks is incorrect.
So Interpol is the international police organization. It's in theory, a quite useful and positive contribution to society, because the main purpose is to catch fugitives. If somebody, let's say, commits a crime in the United States and then flees to Canada, Interpol is supposed to catch them as they cross the border or do various other types of things. And so it's a way for law enforcement to work together internationally to catch bad guys. The problem is that every country in the world, minus one or two, is a member of Interpol, and not every country in the world has the same standards of rule of law and decency and honesty as every other country. And so I have a lot of personal experience with this, because I have, over the years, become one of the prime enemies of Vladimir Putin. I became his enemy after my lawyer, Sergei Magnitsky, was murdered, and I spent the next few years fighting for justice for him, which led to something called the Magnitsky Act, which Putin hates more than anything. And in retaliation for that, Vladimir Putin has used Interpol and we're coming up now to the seventh time where they've tried to use the Interpol arrest warrant system, and there are several different types of arrest warrants, which I'll go into in a second, to have me arrested. And Interpol, in theory, has a safeguard against this, and I say in theory, which is a constitution which says that countries shouldn't use Interpol to arrest political opponents or people for religious reasons or for military reasons. And my case has been clearly defined as a political persecution case, that Vladimir Putin is clearly out to get me because of what I've done with the Magnitsky Act. And so, in theory, Interpol shouldn't ever be used to have me arrested. But that has not stopped Vladimir Putin from using the Interpol system seven times. The first time was in May of 2013, after the Magnitsky Act was passed. Interpol, about a week later, ruled it to be politically motivated and inadmissible. And then they came back again on the same case in July of 2013. Again, Interpol ruled it inadmissible. And then on and on and on and on. I was recently arrested in Madrid, Spain, in May of last year, as I was going to the Spanish prosecutor on his invitation to give evidence about Russian organized crime in Spain. And I was arrested before my meeting on a Russian Interpol arrest warrant. And most recently, in the last few weeks, Russia has applied for the seventh time. And so what do you do in a situation like this? This is kind of like the United Nations, where Venezuela and Saudi Arabia are on the Human Rights Council. Here you've got Russia, which is a full paying member of Interpol, just repeatedly and continuously abusing the system. And it's a really bad situation. And I've been lucky in the sense that I have a very high profile. The media is very interested in me. My case is very clear cut. But for every me who's well-resourced, high profile, and with great media coverage, there's many small human rights activists, justice activists, environmental activists that don't have all the benefits that I have that are being chased up, rounded up all over the world by Russia.
Let me ask you about that. I mean, you know, your case has been very celebrated, and, you know, Russia can be annoying and inconvenience you, but at the end of the day, you tweet out or send a message out that another red notice or whatever has gone out, and, you know, the world kind of mobilizes really fast. How much of this is a Bill Browder Putin problem, and how generalizable is the problem? I.e., are you the tip of a very large iceberg that's the visible tip? How many, you know, people are being oppressed by this sort of, you know, tyrannical governments abusing the Interpol process?
Well, the answer is many, many. Many people come to me, and Jago, who's with us today, who's a good friend, is in the business of helping out those people that don't have the same type of profile that I do, and he's got some unbelievable stories of people from Russia and from many other countries that have this that are being chased by oppressive dictatorial regimes, and I would say that Russia is probably one of the biggest abusers, but maybe not even the biggest abuser. I mean, I've heard these unbelievable stories about how Turkey is Erdogan, who's chasing up anybody who he doesn't like through Interpol, is just issuing these red notices and diffusion notices like candy. And so this is a major, major problem. Many people, you know, you'll only know about the ones you know about, but, you know, there's Enes Kantor, a Turkish basketball player who is living in the United States, is on the Interpol system because he's criticized Erdogan. Or you had in Australia a football player from Bahrain who was on the Interpol from Bahrain for criticizing the government, and he was arrested in Thailand. You hear about the sports stars, you hear about the big hedge fund managers, but for every one of us that you hear about, there's literally thousands of people who are being illegally persecuted using this system by Interpol. And it's a real shame because Interpol serves an extremely valuable purpose, which is you don't want people committing crimes in your country to be able to get away in other countries. It's like a public swimming pool. You know, the moment that people start pissing in the pool, then no one wants to swim in it. And that's the problem with all these countries that abuse the system.
All right, Jago, which part of that formulation, it's a pretty damning formulation of the case. It's an international organization that's supposed to be assisting governments in going after fugitives, assisting authoritarian governments in going after dissidents for political reasons. Which part of that do you buy, and which part of it is, in your judgment, overstated or incorrect?
I agree with Bill's analysis there. Actually, the what's happened is that Interpol has been weaponized by certain states to go after exiled dissidents, and as Bill has highlighted, Fair Trials has represented dozens of people now from all sorts of countries, from Venezuela and Egypt and Indonesia and countries in Central Asia, Russia, Bahrain, Belarus, you know, you name it. Huge number of countries have been misusing Interpol's systems. What I'd perhaps do is emphasize a few points. So one would be, Bill mentioned as one of the weaknesses of Interpol, its global membership in terms of the failure of many of the 194 member countries of Interpol, their failure to respect the rule of law and basic human rights standards. I agree that creates huge challenges for Interpol, but actually it's also one of the things that makes Interpol valuable. You know, Interpol's mission is connecting police for a safer world. And its global reach and its global membership, sure, it creates huge challenges, but it also is what makes this an important and useful organization for the world's police. I mentioned lots of countries. Russia certainly is a country that is abusing the system, and we've seen lots of cases of abuse from Russia. But it's definitely not the only one. The other point I'd just emphasize is, you know, the situation with abuse of Interpol, you know, has been systemic and significant. And what I'd emphasize, though, is that Interpol has finally started to wake up to that. So it has made some quite significant improvements in the past 3 or 4 years to try and insulate itself against being abused by these countries. And some of those changes are already having a significant impact. So we now have protections for refugees. So people that have asylum can get off Interpol's lists and shouldn't be put on them. We have Interpol now reviewing red notices before they're circulated. They used to allow countries to just update these things onto its databases straight away without any prior review at all. And they've also really souped up the oversight mechanism, the redress mechanism, the place you go if you're subject to a red notice to try and get it removed. I mean, it's still not working brilliantly. There are still huge challenges. But Interpol is starting to recognize the problem. And really what it's starting to do is to recognize that it needs to not just have its rules and its commitment to political impartiality and to human rights as kind of a dressing that you kind of put on top of Interpol, but as actually really meaningful rules about how the police have to cooperate, the rules they have to abide by if Interpol's to work. And so it's really giving some teeth to those rules and making sure that they're complied with. And that's a tough job for Interpol. It started the work, but there's a huge amount more to do.
All right. So it sounds like you guys basically agree on the nature of the problem. And so my question is, Bill, do you buy that progress is happening, or is your sense that the situation is a little bit more primitive and raw than that?
Well, coming back to this whole international organization thing, just to give you an example, the guy who was responsible for all of the attempts to have me arrested from Russia, his name is Gorodov. He was working in the Russian prosecutor's office. And now this same guy is working in the Interpol Commission for the Control of Files, which is the quality control commission to vet whether these notices are politically motivated. So you have this guy who's 7 times abused the system to try to have me arrested for Vladimir Putin, and he's now the guy that I've got to appeal to say that this is politically motivated. That's absurd. It's like having Saudi Arabia on the Human Rights Commission at the United Nations. And so, yes, Interpol has changed some of their rules. And yes, like, for example, they have to vet red notices. So what does Russia do? There's 2 types of notices. There's a red notice and a diffusion notice. So if the red notices are now being vetted and they can't get them through on me so easily, they start issuing diffusion notices. And so just imagine, you know, the Russians, the Putin regime is a criminal regime, and they're just looking for whatever easy loopholes there are. I mean, look, Russia even tried to have their own person become president of Interpol. So it really is kind of flawed because of its international nature. And the only way to fix that is for the civilized countries of the world to effectively take charge of this institution and put in place really strict rules for the uncivilized countries so they can't abuse it.
All right. So before we go on and home in on that idea and that proposal, Jago, just walk us through what is the difference between a diffusion order and a red notice so that we're all sort of talking on the same basis here.
Sure. So a red notice is a formal Interpol stamp of approval, digital wanted person alert. So if Interpol issues one of those, it goes to every member country of Interpol and it has Interpol's stamp of approval. A diffusion is a kind of informal version of a red notice. It's sent out more like a kind of email, and countries can select, you know, which other member countries of Interpol that goes to. In practical terms, the impact is very minimal, if it exists at all. So if you imagine an officer at a border point, they don't recognize the difference between a red notice and a diffusion. They just see something that's come through Interpol, which says that a person is wanted. So, you know, the process is different for getting one of these things out, but the impact on individuals concerned is huge. And actually, Fair Trials for some time has been arguing for the same kind of a proper review process for diffusions as Interpol is now doing for red notices, because as Bill highlighted, countries do seem to be using diffusions now to get around the protections that have been put in place for red notices. I think the number of diffusions doubled last year, which is perhaps in response to the fact it's harder for countries to get red notices. So, I mean, there is a huge challenge there.
But let me just to highlight the point about how difficult this problem is. Imagine that one of the people who is a Russian GRU hacker who Bob Mueller indicted for interfering in stealing, you know, DNC and Hillary Clinton campaign emails, and who is now safely in Russia, travels abroad, right? The mechanism by which the United States might well get custody of that person is by having used a red notice or diffusion to a bunch of other countries to let them know, hey, you know, this Jago Russell character is wanted, you know, and we use that system on a regular basis. Is that fair?
That's absolutely fair. You know, this kind of thing is a hugely important tool for police forces to use in exactly that kind of scenario.
And we expect when we send out that notice that countries and the agency itself are not going to spend a lot of time looking behind it other than the fact that there really is an indictment. And we expect a certain deference to our criminal justice system. And maybe later there'll be an extradition process in which we have to sort of justify it. But as an initial matter, just detain the person. We don't expect that the agency is going to spend a lot of time looking behind our arrest warrant. And so then you turn that around and you say, in a world where states kind of expect comedy, how can we demand that kind of deference and then also say that the agency shouldn't be showing it to Vladimir Putin when he issues a diffusion for Bill, right?
Yeah. Well, and I think this is exactly where Bill's comments around a country's track record come in. You know, if you are a country that has not repeatedly misused the red notice system, then you might expect Interpol to process your request very quickly. I mean, that doesn't mean it shouldn't look at it at all, but it should process it quickly. And I think it's absolutely right that there should be more diligence in the case of countries where there has been a pattern of abuse. I completely recognize that there needs to be a process for getting this information out to the world's police quickly. But given the human impact of these things, particularly where countries are known to have been misusing the system for political purposes, I think Interpol, if it's to maintain its credibility, you know, has to do the job of checking that it's not politically motivated. And that's not going to always be easy. You know, some cases are, you know, in a grey area. But there are many cases that we've seen getting through the net that have Interpol has approved, where actually any basic Google search would show that this person is a prominent political opposition leader or human rights activist. So I think there does need to be scrutiny by Interpol before things are sent out. And I think the degree of scrutiny has to relate to the track record of the country in question.
So it seems to me if there's an area of difference between the two of you here, it is chiefly over how redeemable the system is. You know, Bill sounds quite pessimistic about the idea of reform of the organization and has a, the example, Bill, that you cite of the guy who's sending out red notices for you now being in charge of political vetting of red notices is a pretty powerful negative example. So I guess my question is to Bill, how pessimistic are you that there is any, that there's any structure available in which, you know, countries like Russia or Erdogan's Turkey could meaningfully and usefully participate? And should we just exclude them from it? So let's start there and then I'll explore your answer with Jago.
Well, I saw a very interesting study by a guy named Ted Bromond, who's also an expert in this from the Heritage Foundation, where he looked at sort of the good countries of the world, the democratic countries of the world versus the bad ones, the sort of dictatorships. And he determined that some very high number, I think it was like 90% of the budget of Interpol actually comes from the good countries of the world. So, when you know, it's always, everything is always about money at the end of the day. And so the good countries of the world can basically, if they wanted to, and they wanted to be forceful about this, change the rules of Interpol to make it functional so it doesn't get debased by these types of things. And so then the question is, what how do you change the rules so it doesn't get debased? And I would argue that it's probably no different than any other, like the International Olympic Committee. If a country routinely cheats in the Olympics, like Russia did, they got suspended, and then they had to prove that they weren't cheating anymore to be let back in. There's a lot of people who have a lot of bad things to say about the Olympic Committee, and I'm certainly one of them. But the idea that Russia was actually suspended from the Olympics is a very powerful analogy. And so here you have got a situation where Russia, there is no consequences to go after Bill Browder seven times. You know, or eight times or nine times. There's nothing bad.
Don't happen. Give them any ideas.
And so why would they change their behavior? The only way that people change their behavior if there are sort of rewards for good behavior and sanctions for bad behavior. And the rewards for good behavior, as Jago said, is that your notices should be approved and put out almost immediately. And the sanctions for bad behavior is that no. You can't use the system until you've proven that you fixed yourself. And from my perspective, that's the way that you have to do it in order to create checks and balances and risks and rewards for different countries doing things. And you know, probably Jago would argue or others would argue, well, you want Russia in the system. I'm not sure that you need them in the system because they don't extradite or arrest fugitives that go into Russia. And if you know, look at Litvinenko, look at these two guys who are down in Salisbury doing the Skripal poisoning. Are the Russians handing them over? No, the Russians don't hand over anybody, any fugitives in their country. And so it's not as if we're somehow creating, lowering the standard of international law enforcement if you create this penalty for Russia.
All right. So, Jago, do you buy that? What would be, why not just take the position Interpol should be a cooperative international organization of countries with reasonably civilized law enforcement apparatuses that are not using them to oppress dissidents, and it should cooperate episodically and as a matter of its own convenience, if at all, with countries that do not observe those norms? Why is that not the right answer here?
Well, I mean, the first thing to say is those kinds of institutions exist already. So there are already, so Europol, which Canada and the United States and others engage in, there are those kind of mechanisms for close democratic countries to cooperate. And they cooperate much more closely through those mechanisms because there's a high level of trust. For me, the big challenge here is, where do you stop in terms of who you suspend? And at the end of the process of going through the list of bad countries, what have you got left? And do you have a global policing organization left any longer? I think if it were Russia as an isolated example, it would make sense to kind of have this conversation about suspending Russia or changing its formal engagement with Interpol. But, you know, China's been misusing the system. Turkey's been misusing the system. Egypt has. Venezuela has. You know, the list goes on. And it's not a static position either. You know, I think the world is more complex than good countries and bad countries and rule of law countries and non-rule of law countries. You know, maybe if you were talking 10 years ago, you would think that Turkey was on the road to becoming a rule of law country. And look what's happened. Since I think it's a complex situation, and I think we need global police cooperation. And again, I completely agree with Bill vis-a-vis Russia not extraditing its own citizens and the injustice that that can create. But actually, we do want Russia to share information through Interpol, even if it's not arresting people, Russian citizens, based on a red notice. We want mechanisms for Russia to share with US police information about people that might be dangerous on the streets of New York or Washington. And that's not to say we shouldn't act robustly to fix Interpol and to make sure there really is a proper rules-based system there. I think that's crucial. But I think we need a global policing organization. I think we need global cooperation to fight crime. And I think it's possible, not easy, but it's possible to do that within a rules-based system. And yeah, that does mean that the countries that are providing the majority of Interpol's funding need to really demand that. I think they've made a policy choice. The US, Europe has made a policy choice in the past to be really lax about this, to not take the rules seriously, and to just accept that there'll be a bit of collateral damage from time to time and a few individuals' lives will be messed up as a result of these abusive red notices. And I think those countries really need to take it seriously now. They ought to be ring-fencing some funding for Interpol to make sure it's only using that funding to review red notices. It needs to make sure that Interpol is looking with more diligence at requests from countries that are repeatedly abusing the system. I think it should demand more transparency. I don't see why we as the kind of global community shouldn't know which countries are repeatedly being found to abuse the system. I think we ought to know that. And actually, if you take a country like the United States or Australia, there are a number of countries are still acting and detaining people on the basis of politically motivated and abusive red notices. So we can actually start by looking at what we do in our own countries in terms of not, you know, causing, you know, detention and human rights abuses by acting on red notices from countries like Russia or Egypt that we know are abusive. So I think we don't want to end up without a global policing organization, but we need to end up with a global policing organization that works and that is insulated from abuse.
Okay, so I want to follow up on that because it seems to me, as I listen to the two of you, a large amount of the question in my mind, whether we should go the sort of throw the bums out approach that Bill is advocating, with which I have a lot of sympathy, by the way, or whether we should go, hey, you need to keep them in the tent because we get a lot out of having a global police architecture and a sort of measure of baseline, if low trust, cooperation. A lot of the merits of that question to me hinges on what do we get out of having Russia in Interpol or having bad countries in Interpol other than abusive red notices. And so, Jago, my follow-up question is, leaving aside the bad stuff that we accrue as a result of having this, what is the actual value of the real law enforcement cooperation that we get from having a whole lot of bad actors in Interpol?
Well, I mean, even the bad actors have legitimate political cases that they want to pursue. So, you know, murders take place on the streets of Moscow, and, you know, drug dealing gangs, you know, are coordinated through Moscow. And actually, there are legitimate law enforcement purposes to try and assist in the prosecution of those proper criminal cases. So I wouldn't suggest that anything like the majority of red notices or requests for cooperation coming from even bad states are abusive. And so I think there's a value in continuing to collaborate on the basis of these kind of legitimate uses of Interpol by those states. And as I say, I think there is value in having a mechanism for sharing information from countries with, you know, whose human rights records we might have serious concerns about, that to receive information from those countries to try and help bring criminals to justice or to fight crime. And as I say, I think those are significant benefits. And I think that the changes that would need to be made at Interpol to insulate the system against abuse, that it's possible. I don't think you have to throw the baby out with the bathwater. I think you can keep these benefits and insulate against abuse.
Bill, do you buy that there are significant benefits? I mean, when we were talking earlier, you were saying, you know, hey, Russia doesn't actually detain anybody on the basis of other countries' red notices. And the benefits that Jago is just describing is really benefits that we get by helping control crime in Russia and in Turkey. They're not reciprocity benefits. So how do you assess how much baby there is along with the bathwater?
Well, I can really only speak as an expert about Russia, and Russia is a criminal state. It's an entire the entire apparatus of the Putin regime is to commit crimes. They commit murders. The regime commits murders. They do it in the country. They do it outside the country. They do financial crimes. They do every. It's a criminal enterprise, and so it's effectively by allowing Russia to be a member of Interpol, you're allowing criminals to have access to your information. And so, I mean, just to give you a sort of parallel example, we've been investigating the money laundering, the international money laundering connected to the Magnitsky murder, my lawyer's murder, for the last 9 years. And whenever we get a criminal case opened in a country, Russia then applies to that country for mutual legal assistance and asks for the case file to find out what we know and what the law enforcement of that country knows. Not because they're interested in solving the crime, but because they're interested in figuring out how to cover up for the crime. And so I can't speak for the whole system, but what I can say is that when you have countries like Russia that are abusing the Interpol to go after honest people that are their enemies, and then abusing Interpol to like figure out if they're going to get away with their crimes, I would say that Russia should be suspended and real hard control should be put in place so that it can't be abused by these criminals. And Jago was mentioning, you know, a country or Europol because people don't trust Interpol. Well, why should we, you know, why not just create a system in Interpol where it's rigorous, where if a country like Russia abuses it, then they get suspended. And the best way of being unsuspended is to behave themselves. I don't see how that's a bad thing. Otherwise there's absolutely no reason why any country will behave themselves unless there's real consequences for misbehavior.
Okay, so Jago, the alternative in your mind to throwing the bums out is reform of the institution. You said earlier that there had been substantial policy changes. Bill has raised I think, pretty strong prima facie concern that the implementation of those policy changes is not all that encouraging. How encouraged, in your judgment, should we be by the combination of policy changes and implementation of policy changes by Interpol? And when you say there is still a lot of work left to do, what's your sense of the scope of work? What would have to happen to make Interpol something that you could take back to Bill and say, hey, look, I know they issued 7 red notices and diffusion orders against you, but we're actually in a different place now.
Yeah, I think the changes have been significant. I think significant on paper and in practice. So, I mean, as Bill said, most of the people that Fair Trials represents are people with asylum. They're refugees. They've fled persecution. And the vast majority of the people that we've helped have benefited as a result of this new policy within Interpol that enables refugees to get removed from the system. And that policy seems to be working very efficiently. In most cases, people are removed very quickly. That's a really significant change. There are better reviews of red notices now. And the redress mechanism, the place you go to complain, is, in the vast majority of cases, operating very effectively. So I think they are significant changes. In terms of what I think still needs to be done to protect the system, implementation is a massive job. Actually making sure that these existing rules, these rules are implemented properly, are being enforced, requires a huge amount of work. And Interpol is still not putting enough manpower and resource behind doing these reviews of red notices before they're circulated across the globe. This body, the Commission for the Control of Interpol's Files that you complain to, has had a huge increase in the number of applications to get data removed, a huge increase from you know, around 200 requests in 2010 to 2,200 in 2017. And it still doesn't have anything like the resources that it needs. So I think we need to see these existing rules implemented properly. We need a lot more transparency. We need a lot more transparency in terms of numbers and data and which countries are abusing the system. I think we all need to see that, partly to see whether these reforms are working, but to really understand how this relatively secretive organization works. I think on personnel, on key personnel roles, before the potential Russian president was announced as the front runner for that role at the end of last year, Fair Trials had written to Interpol saying it needs a much more transparent and open process for appointing people to these roles and to roles on the CCF, and that needs to involve evidence of the country that they're representing's abuse of the system, so data on abuse of the system, but also information on the individuals concerned, so that there can be proper global scrutiny to make sure that the right people are being put into these important positions. And this issue of diffusions that we've talked about, the fact that countries seem to be able to get around the protections for red notices by using diffusions instead, that needs fixing. We're being told now that Interpol has implemented some new regime where it's doing better checks, but nobody's explaining clearly what that looks like. And we need robust prior scrutiny of all the information that's sent out. And I would just like to come back on this point about throwing out the buns and just emphasize again, you know, it's not just Russia. And so one of the things that concerns me, for example, is if you have somebody that committed a horrendous human rights abuse in Russia, that's gone and set up a lovely, comfortable life for themselves in say, Turkey. You know, if you start suspending countries, you'll also end up suspending Turkey, because they're probably a worse abuser of the system right now than Russia. And then there's no way to pursue a prosecution of that person that might have been a murderer or a torturer or a corrupt law enforcement official. And so I think also there's a human rights benefit to being able to use Interpol and to stop creating safe havens for people that commit those kinds of crimes.
But doesn't that assume a degree of reciprocity that doesn't exist? In the sense that if you're relying on the reciprocity benefits of a system like Interpol to address the impunity of people who are in those countries, you're assuming some degree of good faith participation of the countries in question, no?
Sure. I mean, in that case, for that to work, you'd need Turkey to be willing to arrest the person and extradite or prosecute them. But actually, Turkey may well be willing to do that if they don't have a direct interest in the individual concerned. Yeah, this system is a system for circulating notifications, and the decisions on what action is taken when that notification is received is for the state concerned.
So, Bill, what would you need to see when you imagine a sort of throw the bums out, let them back in when they've reformed? What would you have to see from, and let's just use Russia because it's not because it's necessarily the worst offender, but because it's the one with which you're most familiar. What would you need to see from the Putin government before you would be willing to see Russia be a member in good standing of Interpol such that when they issued a diffusion, it would be reasonable for the government of Spain to pick up Bill Browder in a hotel?
Well, I guess I, what I would need to see is me and the 50 other people I know who are not criminals who are on the red notice system to have those red notice all deleted, not by Interpol, but by Russia. So that we don't, I have a constant flow of people coming to my office who have Interpol red notices from Russia, who are activists and agitators and political opponents, who shouldn't be having to come to my office to talk to me about this stuff. And Russia will abuse whatever system they have access to its maximum possible advantage. And so Jago's points are all beautiful in theory. And Jago deserves huge credit for this, for the role of refugees and asylum seekers not being on Interpol. I think that that's his singular accomplishment. But while that's been done, I'm still fighting the seventh red notice from Russia. The seventh, you know, I'm communicating with the Commission for the Control of Files where Mr. Gorodov, who has been my pursuer, is on the commission. It's just, I mean, whatever the theory is, I'm right at the coalface and it ain't working.
So both of you have alluded to this leadership election that happened last year in which a Russian law enforcement official was almost but wasn't named to head Interpol. That actually strikes me as a sort of major vote of no confidence in the institution that that could have even come close to happening under the circumstances. And so, Bill, how bad was it?
Well, it was a shocking story, and it involves both me and Jago. So Jago was the one who knew about it first. And it was, I think the election was going to be happening on a Wednesday. And I got an email from Jago on the Friday before the Wednesday saying, Bill, are you aware that a Russian is the front runner for the presidency of Interpol? And I had no idea, and nor did the rest of the world have any idea. And so it was one of these things where, you know, whatever was going on at Interpol, as Jago said, there's no transparency at all. And so I started calling around to some journalists, and I started calling around some other Russian dissidents, and everybody was in shock. And the way I imagined this, and I can't say for sure because I wasn't there, but this was how Russia was dealing with Interpol the same way as they deal with FIFA, the Football Association, or with the International Olympic Committee, which is they were going around with envelopes of cash, giving the guy from the Central African Republic or Angola, you know, $5,000 to vote with Russia. And so with Jago and myself and I got Mikhail Hordakovsky involved. We held a big press conference. We all started to alert the world, and different policymakers and politicians got involved. And they said, well, if Interpol is going to be run by a Russian, the Lithuanian government or parliament said, if Interpol is going to be run by a Russian, then we don't want to be members of Interpol anymore. And I think that there was so much outrage around the Western world that over the course of 5 days, Russia, which had, I think, locked it up, lost their lockup, and thank God the South Korean candidate was elected. But had Russia, I mean, I don't think Interpol would have survived that as an institution if a Russian was the president of Interpol.
Jago, was it less bad than that in any way? I mean, if you're somebody who is going to be, who is trying as you are to make the case for the non-exclusion of countries like Russia and sort of keep them in the tent, this must have been like the worst case scenario for you, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, we were hugely concerned because, you know, Interpol has been making some changes and there has been support for continued reform. So the idea of having a Russian delegate leading the organization was a huge concern to us. So although we wouldn't advocate for suspension of Russia, certainly a country that has been repeatedly abusing the system shouldn't be allowed to take this kind of leading role. But actually that whole episode also demonstrates to me a much kind of a broader issue too, which is that governments really took their eye off the ball, and there was a complete lack of transparency from Interpol. So it was really, you know, just a matter of days before this election happened that anybody knew anything about it. And I think what one of the key lessons for me from that whole episode was really that the governments of the world need to really carefully scrutinize what's going on at Interpol. They should have been making noises about this development, you know, weeks in advance, and trying to make sure that a much better candidate was being put forward. But they really just left it to the police members of Interpol. And, you know, considering the importance of the organization and its impact on people's human rights, that was pretty damning to me, that countries like the US and the UK and other countries in Western Europe just completely taken their eye off the ball and had left the kind of the police members to get on with it.
But isn't that, I mean, this is a good point on which to end, but isn't that the ultimate problem here, is member state inattention? The reason the diffusion and red notice abuse is possible is that member states aren't paying adequate attention. The reason you could have somebody get close to that election from Russia, of all countries, is, as you just said, that member states aren't paying enough attention. And the moment countries like Lithuania and other countries start saying, hey, if you don't clean up your act, we're getting out of this, that then, you know, you elect a South Korean and the problem or that aspect of the problem goes away. Isn't the ultimate answer to this problem, one way or another, for the member states that actually are committed to rule of law systems to put down their feet and say, you know, we demand that the organization comport with certain norms, both in its staffing and in its rules and in its implementation of the rules?
I think that's absolutely right. I think the problem is that in the area of international police or terrorism cooperation, the policy decision has been made by countries that they'll cooperate, and that they won't worry too much about the rules within which that cooperation has to happen. And, you know, Interpol is a prime example of that. And actually, countries do need to take this stuff seriously, and they do need to enforce rules-based cooperation. And I think a lot of the problems with Interpol can be fixed and will be fixed if countries really take compliance with the rules seriously and don't wait for some big kind of news story to emerge in the press, that they're actively monitoring what's going on and demanding that Interpol ups its game and really provides, after all, they're paying for this service, that Interpol really provides a quality service to the world's police by making sure that reliable information is being circulated.
Bill, do you think that there is, you know, if member states started paying attention between Bill Browder diffusion notices rather than only when, you know, Mike McFaul tweets out that, you know, his outrage at the latest Bill Browder detention somewhere, how much of the problem does that address if we could get sustained attention to the institution in the interstices?
Well, fortunately or unfortunately, it's not just Bill Browder's anymore. There's a lot of other headline-grabbing stories. So it generates a constant level of attention because there's so many different abuses. I mean, just these three stories I started out with, the Bahraini football player, the Turkish basketball player, myself, have all been in the news pretty consistently for the last year. And so it's not as if anyone can sort of hide or forget about this issue. There is a constant issue of Interpol abuse from bad countries, and it needs to be fixed. And whatever the structural fixes are that have been put in place, they're not enough. And it really does need to be tightened up dramatically. And there's a lot of proposals out there to tighten it up. I do think that the General Secretary of Interpol, Jürgen Stock, is a German police officer, is a very capable guy. And I think he understands the existential risk to the organization of doing stuff badly, and he's trying his best. But there's just so much bad stuff being done by the member states that the person who's general secretary can't stop. He can't tell the Russians not to issue that seventh red notice for Bill Browder. They can just go and do it. And so the rules need to be changed by the members, by the shareholders, by the people who put the money in.
We're going to leave it there. Bill Browder, Jago Russell, thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. This week, special thanks to Michaela Fogel and Matt Kahn, who brought in both of our guests from London seamlessly. You could barely even tell. Our music is, of course, as always, performed by Sophia Yan. The Lawfare podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patya Howell. And by the way, if you haven't shared it on Facebook, Twitter, and whatever social media you used and given it a 5-star rating on your choice of podcast distribution services, get on that, folks. You can get Lawfare merch at thelawfarestore.com. And as always, thanks for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.